Tour. Auf die Rechte.
Der deutsche Spargelkult müsse enden.
Germany's beleaguered defense minister has temporarily dropped his PhD title.
Volkswagen ist eine Perle der deutschen Industrie. Und ich glaube, das kann man
nicht sagen. Ich weiß, wie viel Liebe dahinter steckt. Wenn Glühweinstände aufgebaut werden, wenn Waffen...
Spargel-Weltmeister ist China, denn die bauen 60 Mal...
Hey, this is Ted.
Hi, it's Misha.
Welcome back to Spaßbremse. We've got a very important and unfortunately extremely timely episode for you today. It's an interview with the historian Ned Richardson Little about the post-war history of the German far right. Ned's an expert on the topic and he does an excellent job narrating the evolution of the radical right from the end of the Second World War up to the present and also offering a little glimpse into the future. He gives us a lot of important historical context and background about how we got to where we are today in the relatively dire position we're in, with the far-right Alternative for Germany party now reaching record highs in a number of polls. That's both at the federal and state level, as we discuss in the episode. We don't discuss it directly either, but it's also worth noting that in neighboring Austria, the far-right Freedom Party is now actually leading polls nationally at roughly 30%. So this is an issue across the German-speaking world and something that we really thought was worth getting into with a full episode. You also might have seen that in the eastern state of Thuringia, the CDU just partnered with the AfD to lower the property transfer tax. This is actually the exact type of episode that Ned suggests will erode the quote, firewall or Brandmauer between the center and far right. So it was eerie to see it happen the day, actually right after we recorded the interview. Overall, it's a heavy topic, of course, but Ned's a wonderful guide, and he gets us beyond the decontextualized headlines that you'll see everywhere. So I think you'll really enjoy the episode.
Yeah, this is a good one. But before we get it rolling, just a couple quick announcements. If you can, we'd very much appreciate your support on Patreon to keep the podcast up and running. We just released part two of our two-part series on German youth parties, which pairs nicely with this episode, of course, since we discussed the extremely racist youth wing of the AfD. You can also access our entire archive if you subscribe, and last but not least, we'll send you a sticker if you do.
They're good stickers. We just got a fresh batch in.
Yeah, they're like matte.
Yeah.
They're pretty nice. Also, we have a live show coming up at Podfest Berlin on Saturday, October 14th at noon. More details to follow, but you won't want to miss it because I will also be there on mic in case.
We know everyone's been missing Michelle, and this will be a chance to hear from her live. So that'll be good. We've got a great topic. We won't spoil it for now, but it should be a lot of fun.
So come see us on Saturday, October 14th at noon in Berlin.
Exactly. And with that, let's cut to the interview. Hey, everyone, and welcome to Spaßbremse. I'm joined here today by Ned Richardson Little, who's a researcher at the University of Erfurt and a primary investigator on a project about a liberal constitutionalism in East Central Europe. And I have him here today to talk about one of the more alarming recent trends in Germany, which is the rise of the far right, or maybe resurgence of the far right, depending on how you want to label it, or just resurfacing of far-right trends that have always been there. We'll get into exactly how we want to define these trends. But Ned has a lot of great insights about the far-right in Germany, as well as German politics and history more generally. And I'm really excited to have him on and share some insights about where we are, how concerning recent trends are, and how we got here. So Ned, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Look forward to talking about the resurgence of fascism in Germany.
Cheery topic on this Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
just by way of context, I mean, I would assume this is something that a lot of people have heard about, but a few of the things that have grabbed the headlines recently, we had Alice Fidel of the AFD coming out with a real heater here, saying she doesn't like to celebrate the end of World War II and the liberation because she doesn't like to celebrate Germany losing wars. And then on the more respectable, put that in air quotes, center right, Friedrich Merz saying that, you know, Kreuzberg isn't Germany. Of course, Kreuzberg coded as a relatively immigrant rich part of Berlin, and saying, you know, that's not the real Germany, and saying some goofy sounding Bavarian town is Gillemus or whatever. And there was the AFD win in the town of Sonnenberg, and generally the AFD, the far right alternative for Germany party, doing extremely well in polling across the country, and in specific eastern states as well. So on the federal level, they're polling higher than any of the current governing parties, roughly 21%, you'll see, the far right AFD. That's outpacing the SPD, Greens, and FDP, and just trailing the center right CDU by about 5 points. Whereas in specific eastern states like Saxony and Thuringia, the AFD has an outright lead in the polling. Recently in Saxony, you saw almost 40% for the AFD, which would actually give them a majority of seats if that election were held today and with that result. And in Thuringia, about 33% or so, which wouldn't give them an outright majority, but still the plurality there. So that's just a little bit of background here, both on the actual parliamentary kind of statistical side here about how the polling looks, as well as these more kind of qualitative expressions of sentiment that the far right politicians feel comfortable saying things like, you know, that Germany shouldn't really feel bad for World War II. And so it gives you an idea of this moment we're in, that both these parties are doing well, and there's a bit of the norms are breaking down a bit, and people are willing to say things that would have been considered very taboo on both the center right and the far right. And so I really think we need to talk about what this means and how we got here. And I'm very excited, as I said, to have Ned on to do this. And to provide some context, I think it's definitely necessary to get into the history. You know, we want to talk about exactly what it means today, but without a little bit of an overview of the role of the far right in post-1945, post-World War II Germany, both East and West, I don't think it's really possible to do that. So Ned, could you take us back a little bit to, let's say, post-1945 and this idea of the Stunde Null, the zero hour or the fresh start in Germany, that we're going to have a new denazified country, and to what extent that's true, to what extent that's a myth, and what sort of role that myth might have continued to play in German politics.
Yeah, I think this is one thing that came out of 2017 when the AfD finally enters the federal parliament. You have this real panic, the idea that sort of Germany, the ideal model citizen of a post-genocidal, post-dictatorship regime, which has sort of committed itself to this memory culture, it's purged the sins of the past, purged the sort of demons of fascism. That this idea that the far right could rise again there in some way was seen as a sort of new, terrifying thing. And the move of the AfD to the federal level was new and frightening in certain ways, but it wasn't a complete sort of break with the past. And I think going back and actually looking at the longer history is important. And I think this sort of concept of 45, this idea of the Stunde Null, the zero hour, that Germany hits the end of the war and this sort of wiping clean of the slate, that the Nazi regime is finished, and from that you both get either a Western-oriented liberal democratic state in the West or a state socialist Warsaw Pact country coming out of East Germany. But the lingering sort of effects and people involved from the Third Reich are still around, and it's something that is sort of often overlooked in these ways. And it's saying part of the mythologization of both states to try to erase this history. And just one of the problems is that the complicity in the Nazi regime and the sheer number of members of the party is so great that neither German state can function without them. You cannot create one German state, let alone two German states, that have no Nazi involvement whatsoever. Just some, and when we look at West Germany, this problem that sort of denazification that's being put through these initial discussions during the wartime, the idea of sort of people putting out they're going to shoot all the officer class, total purging of all institutions. And once you have the Allies in the Western zones actually running things, this problem of, on a logistical level, trying to get things going again, realizing there's a number of ex-Nazis who are convenient to collaborate with. Most famously, in a lot of cases, you've got people on the right who end up sort of joining the Christian Democrats and being part of this sort of new emerging sort of natural governing party, which ends up governing West Germany for the first two decades, or even longer. And then in East Germany, you also have this problem of just the sheer number of people who'd been Nazis sort of filtering into different institutions, in spite of efforts by the Socialist Unity Party, the Moscow aligned Communist Party there, to try and purge out members. But as time goes on within East Germany also, you have a large number of former Nazis who end up in different positions of power, though not at the very top. And the East Germans even create their own sort of small party. They have this sort of strange multi-party system in East Germany, these groups that can't vote against the Socialist Unity Party, but are there to sort of organize different social classes. And they actually create one specifically for middle-class ex-Nazis, because you just need to do something with all these people. And this real problem, on one hand, you've got people who were sort of enthusiastic participants in the Third Reich, some who were just sort of nominally part of it, who then become socialists, become liberal Democrats. And you've got other people who then try to keep certain elements of the Nazi era going in different ways. And when we look at the far right in post-45, it's not people who are trying to sort of maintain the same program of Nazism, because you really can't do that at that point. There's not really a way to maintain, like, the Nazi Party and its rise to power came in such a specific geopolitical era about undoing Versailles, changing borders. And Danny Orbach, an Israeli historian, has this really good sort of concept. You have these different factions who come out basically trying to pick and choose one or two elements of Nazism to hold on to. So some of them come out of it basically just becoming committed anti-communists and decide to become pro-Western. Some of them decide that they just want to be authoritarians and end up sort of going over to work for the Soviet Union or working in the East. But these people who decide that they sort of want to create a anti-Western, anti-communist political movement that's still devoted to racial hierarchy, anti-Semitism. You have these clusters who stick around. And after the founding of West Germany, you have the Socialist Reich Party, which actually is a neo-Nazi party. They are there saying we are continuing on the legacy of the Nazis, and that the current Federal Republic of Germany is an illegitimate entity, but we're still going to participate in its politics to essentially try to overthrow it. They get banned in 1952, and the movement gets scattered a bit. This is right before they banned the Communist Party as well in West Germany. But you have these groups who are basically all trying to figure out what does it mean to be committed to many of the ideals of the Nazi era, but in it after the absolute total crushing defeat of the Nazi regime itself.
Yeah, so that's a great overview of, you know, how things were not the far right was not completely extinguished, of course, after the fall of the Nazi regime, and then also with the founding of the Federal Republic in 1949, of course, the DDR, East Germany, founded at the same time. And then you have in 1950, with the idea of protecting against, you know, any opposition to the liberal democratic regime, you have the founding of the Verfassungsschutz, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, which is Germany's very long-winded named, but domestic intelligence service. And we'll probably touch on this agency quite a bit. Their job is technically to defend against these kind of far-right extremists. They do so with varying degrees of success at various times. But could you run through, maybe, you know, a bit, obviously it'll be a bit of a high-level skimming over it, but for the next several decades, how do the far-right currents look respectively in the Western Federal Republic and the Eastern DDR? And how did extreme right currents evolve differently? And what were the respective state responses? Because there's a lot to be desired on different levels, I think you could say, whether that's the proclaimed liberal democratic West or the anti-fascist East, both don't do the best job of fighting fascism in different ways.
Yeah, it's when you look at West Germany, you've got these sort of underground currents of neo-Nazi who still exist. And in East Germany as well, there's sort of reports that come up within the socialist system of youth who are still sort of putting swastikas on the school board, there's a classroom chalkboard within different youth groups, people still sort of coming out and saying positive things about Hitler. And that within West Germany, you've got sort of, in this period, sort of things go a bit more dormant, but it really revives in the 1960s, also as part of a backlash against 1968. And this one, at the end of the 1960s, even though the Communist Party and this neo-Nazi Socialist Reich Party had been banned, you have a sort of new successor party to both gets founded. And the sort of boundaries of politics open up a bit more on both the far left and the far right. And this is when you have the National Democratic Party, the NPD, gets founded. And this is really the first big scare about the far right in West Germany coming back. And one that's sort of the precursor to what we're seeing now with the AfD. In 1969, they come very close to hitting the 5% margin you need to enter into the federal parliament. And they actually made it into the Bavarian parliament before that on a regional level. So there is this sort of research, even though you'd had this ban of the party, officially neo-Nazism isn't allowed. You have coming up in organized party form. On the other hand, within the Christian Democratic Union, you do have a former Nazi, Hans-Georg Kiesinger, who becomes chancellor in 1966, which causes a certain amount of consternation. There's a famous incident sort of within the federal parliament of a former Nazi actually denouncing socialists and making anti-Semitic comments. And he actually gets attacked by two members of the Social Democrats physically and sort of try to remove him. And there's sort of these ongoing conflicts that you have a parliamentary system which has ex-Nazis and ex-anti-fascists who are in the same place trying to conduct normal liberal parliamentary affairs. And there's a certain amount of tension that comes with that. And at the same time as the NPD is coming back, you have Willy Brandt, who is a former anti-fascist underground fighter who ends up becoming chancellor of West Germany. And running for the Social Democrats, and it's the first transition away from the Christian Democrats running the country on its own. In East Germany, when it comes to the far right, you really have sort of more of a pause up until the 1980s when things get going again. Not the idea that the entire country had embraced the anti-fascist ethos and anti-racism, because you do have lingering anti-racist tendencies that come out with things like attacks on foreign guest workers. There's an incident in Erfurt where I work, people are trying to get commemorated now, of a mob attack on a group of Algerian guest workers. In a lot of cases, this comes out of interpersonal clashes in places like bars, often with people sort of getting into fights, and particularly questions about sexual relations between foreigners and German women, and this question sort of the psychosexual aspect of racism, which goes back to a lot of Nazi anti-Semitism. So within the population, you still have a lot of these things floating around, even if publicly they are the antithesis to what the state says its ideological position is. And at the same time, it's also things that are officially discouraged, but also covered up when they occur.
And so is it fair to say you have, you know, maybe not parallel, but there's some similar tendencies of racism, obviously, as there would be in any society. There maybe because of the denial of the East German state, because they were so anathema to how it framed its ideology, they're left being a bit more isolated, incoherent, and not really represented institutionally in quite the same way. Whereas in the Federal Republic, even though it's also counter to a lot of how a lot of the state would want to see itself, especially of course the SPD and the anti-fascist like Willy Brandt, it's allowed to manifest a little bit more institutionally, and you can actually see these structures a bit more. I think that could be a way of describing what you said. But then how do things change in the 1980s? Because this is when you hear, as you alluded to, actually more systematic kind of violence and right-wing extremism going on in the East. And again, the socialist state there doesn't really want to discuss this too much, but it becomes clear that this is happening on a widespread enough level that it's pretty hard to deny. And people especially talk about this now that there's more ability to discuss it. What are the explanations for why this started happening in the 80s? Is this just sort of because of the declining living standards in the socialist East, and there's just sort of nothing to really hold the society together anymore? Are there broader political currents? Or like what kind of explains this rise of the right in the East that then after unification we'll see transition into some of the more modern political currents we see today?
I think one of the things in East Germany in the 80s is that you don't, although the collapse in 1989 was very rapid, you have this steady collapse in any kind of sort of sentiment of loyalty or participation in the system. And particularly in the early 80s, you have this energy crisis in the Eastern Bloc as the Soviets start cutting off free oil supplies. The standard of living starts dropping. You have problems with housing. And in general, this sense that the system's falling apart and there's no reform or major changes coming. And you see a sort of social breakdown in a lot of places. In 1984, this big wave of people who start trying to emigrate, which only continues to grow until 89. And from these social sort of milieus, you start seeing a lot of youth far-right groups, or far-right activists who then start trying to basically hijack state socialist youth organizations, and especially the paramilitary organizations. You have things like the Society for Sport and Technology, which was meant to be a sort of social organization, not actually part of the compulsory military service, where young people could get together, tune up bicycles, work on radios, and also fire guns. And sort of part of the general militarization in East Germany. And within these groups, you have people with far-right politics trying to take them over and direct them in a far-right direction. At the same time, I think this is also something that comes out of the football scene in certain places. And this is a continuity you see that comes into the 1990s, where these sort of hooligans who are not fully apolitical, but you know, sort of this rising violence connected to certain hooligan scenes, which then starts being pushed in a far right direction. And as not necessarily the idea that everyone had been idealistic socialists to this point, but when the idea that there's a functional system in the East really starts falling apart, people start looking around for different things to believe in. And one place where this dovetails with the official ideology is you have people who are being brought up to believe that sort of West Germany is this decadent, fallen society. And they interpret this as connecting that to the increasing multi-ethnic, multicultural democracy in the West. So nowadays, this sort of denunciation of Kreuzberg from the center right as a sort of alien place. This is something you also got in East Germany, this idea of look at West Berlin, it's not even really German anymore, look at what it's become. And this goes from being a socialist critique of capitalism into a far right critique of the loss of ethno-nationalist purity.
And so after unification, and we should be clear here that, you know, there were a lot of fears about the effects of unification on Germany politically, and that could spur a rise in nationalism and a rise in far-right activity. And this is something that was discussed at the time as a concern. And maybe the worst fears were not played out, but at the same time, it doesn't seem like those fears were entirely unfounded either. Because as you mentioned, you know, if there's no longer this kind of binding ideology of communism, then what's the sort of next thing to believe in? And that becomes, in a lot of cases, German nationalism. Of course, the sort of ideological glue of communism had been weakening for the previous decade, as you mentioned. But with the full fall of the regime, then this kind of political energy can get transitioned into something else. And in a lot of cases, that is German nationalism. And even the chants you see as the East German regime is collapsing, you know, famously kind of changing from "Wir sind das Volk" to "Wir sind ein Volk." You know, we are the people to "We are one people." Very different, you know, slightly different meanings there, but with a huge political ramification of, you know, we are now becoming this kind of ethno German state that we didn't used to be. And that ends up manifesting itself in a lot of really horrific cases of racist violence. You know, a lot of it centered in the East, but not exclusively. So could you talk a bit about the 1990s and the what really ends up forming the foundation of, I think what you could say is the modern far right in a lot of ways in Germany?
Yeah, I mean, to get to the 90s, I think it's also important to look at the rise of the organized far right in the 1980s as well, because you have this, not just the NPD as the sort of basically neo-Nazi party, and then you have things like the Republikaner, the Republican Party, which comes out of a sort of far right splinter faction of the Christian Democrats. And the Christian Democrats in this era, they have what's called sort of the Steel Helmet faction, the sort of national conservative wing. There's always been this sort of chunk on the far right of the Christian Democrats, Christian Social Union, which espouses a lot of ideas which nowadays are specifically considered part of the far right within the AfD. And you start to have a splinter factions move off to create the Republicans, the German People's Union, and they start winning elections at the regional level and the provincial level. And when we get after reunification, it's sort of the Republicans in particular in 89, they're saying we need reunification, but not just the merger of East and West Germany. We need to go back to the borders from 1937. We need to go take back the territory taken by Poland. We need to get Kaliningrad back.
This is the area east of the Oder-Neisse line. We did an episode on this, but just to jog people's memory, you know, what used to be Eastern Germany became Western Poland at the end of World War II, basically as a negotiation among the Allies to give the Soviets what then was Eastern Poland, and then Poland just sort of moved over. But there was this ongoing irredentist sentiment in Germany, you know, for a while, even the Social Democrats, and then that stayed around with the CDU until, I believe, 1991, and Helmut Kohl finally, or maybe it's 1990, like eventually agreed, okay, yeah, we're not going to like go take over part of Poland again. Like we finally give that up. And so, yeah, this, the connections between the far right and the center right.
Yeah, the Helsinki Accords in 1975, when you have this big agreement between Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and North American states, the sort of NATO-Warsaw Pact agreement that we're not going to change borders without peaceful transitions, agreeing on rights and cross-bloc cooperation. This really takes the wind out of the sails of people who are talking about restoring German territory in the East, but you still have a faction within the CDU who's sort of specifically catering to refugees who had been expelled from areas east of the Oder-Neisse line up until reunification, at which point then they sort of draw a hard line. It's like, no, we're just going to merge the two states. We're ending things here. No more territory acquisition. And this is where a lot of the fears of sort of, once you get East and West Germany together, how far are they going to go? Are they going to demand another Anschluss? Is Austria going to be included in this? If we're talking about self-determination of the German nation, doesn't that involve all the Germans? And these are the questions about German nationalism, which go back to Bismarck and the original unification of Germany, of just how many Germans are we talking about here? And so in the early 90s, this solution that comes about with the CDU-led Helmut Kohl government of connecting together German unification and Europeanization. So this sort of linking the two together, trying to really defang how scary it sounds that Germany is now a unified state, and trying to integrate this process of bringing the two Germanys into one Germany, into also the expansion of the EU, the Maastricht Treaty that comes out, the sort of creation of the Schengen zone, all these things, and that this sort of process of reunification is really one that's tied up in very non-threatening European politics. And it's about the ending of the Cold War on peaceful terms. Within sort of outside of that mainstream, this does defang certain aspects of the far right, because a lot of their topic was sort of anti-communism against the division of Germany. And part of the anti-American, anti-British sentiment that sort of the Allies had dismembered Germany for their own purposes. And reunification really sort of resets the stage. But on the regional level, like this is when the Republicans actually get into Parliament in Baden-Württemberg for the first time, two elections in a row. You have the German People's Union in Bremen, but also in Saxony-Anhalt. And as you mentioned, you have some of these horrific attacks conducted by racist mobs or to specifically targeted racist groups. And Germany had seen this before. If we go back to 1980, this group called Wehrsportgruppe Hoffmann, it was a far-right sort of shooting club, just armed organization, quasi-militia, that was tied to the Oktoberfest bombing in 1980. and one that was never fully explained. And going back to the Organization für Verfassungsschutz, the Office for the Protection of the Constitution, these lingering questions of how many informers they have in these far-right groups that conducted terrorist attacks, which meant that things would never be fully explained. And then we get to the 90s, you start having these attacks in, most famously in Rostock Lichtenhagen, where you have a building that was set on fire that was housing Vietnamese guest workers from the East who had made refugees because when they lost their jobs, they lost their papers. You have attacks in Hoyerswerda, but also in the West, in Mölln, in Solingen. You had attacks on sort of homes where people were getting firebombed, killing families. In the early 90s, as a sort of term that people brought out in recent times, has sort of become popularized, the baseball bat years of low-level Nazi terrorism in small towns and small communities, and an unspoken proliferation of far-right sentiments within youth organizations and the sort of day-to-day attacks on minorities and others within both sides of Germany.
And so how does that then transition to what would become a bit more organized in a lot of ways? I mean, something I find particularly interesting is the impact of the anniversary of the Dresden bombings of 1945, so the 50th anniversary then being in 1995. And there's these big marches around that. And that continues throughout, in our current century. You know, Dresden continues to be a real kind of flashpoint for the far right. The idea here being that you can't legally mourn the Nazi regime, but if you mourn the bombings of Dresden, which I think any fair account were an atrocity, but you know, by mourning that, then it sort of is a way of transferring this mourning of the Nazi regime to something that's politically acceptable, but it's still quite clear what's going on. So that's one point, and the Pegida demonstrations. And so how does this evolve into a bit more of a gelling from, like you said, the more inchoate baseball bat to actual parties and movements and these large marches as the years go on towards the 21st century?
Yeah, here's where Dresden's important, because it's also the coming together of West and East. You have these sort of neo-Nazi foot soldiers, guys on the ground in bomber jackets, baseball bats, and skinheads. And then you also have people from the West who are coming in with organization, with money, with influence. And this meeting of the two is what creates the basis for what's happening today, both within the more respectable far right, but also within the resurgence of the more sort of marginalized neo-Nazi scene. And there's a fair bit of fluidity between the two. But with Dresden, it had always been a point for Holocaust revisionism. Also in the West, you have David Irving, British historian, who famously sort of added some extra zeros to the casualty count, turning it from 30,000 people killed in Dresden to 300,000. And this is used as sort of part of this. If we can drop the number of people killed in the Holocaust low enough and can raise the number killed in civilian bombings high enough, all the crimes sort of become equal. And then who's to say if the RAF isn't basically the same as the SS? And so this general push to relativize the Holocaust, especially using Dresden as a symbol. And one thing that I think helps this is the fact that Slaughterhouse-Five, the famous novel by Kurt Vonnegut, he had actually read the work of David Irving and taken this Holocaust revisionism sort of numbers and put it into a popular novel that Americans read in high school. It's one of those odd moments when you're trying to explain how this sort of work of deep humanism that's appalled by atrocity is also informed by a guy who's trying to provide cover for neo-Nazis. It's very confusing when you're teaching American undergraduates. But Dresden then becomes the symbol. Both its rebirth is being used as part of this idea that reunification is allowed for the real reconstruction of Dresden. You have the Church of Our Lady, which had stayed in ruins, the GDR, both for financial reasons, because reconstructing it was incredibly costly. And most of Dresden had to be rebuilt after the firebombing at huge expense. So it was one of the many areas in Dresden that just sort of stayed in ruins. And at the same time, Dresden is this sort of symbol of it finally being able to be revived because of reunification, Western money being poured in. But then it becomes a site for local neo-Nazis and Western far right to come together, as you said, this sort of way in which you can display neo-Nazi sentiment, but cloaked in a way that is not explicitly neo-Nazi. And you had something similar in West Berlin, where people would go and make a march to Spandau Fortress. And this is sort of for demanding the release of Rudolf Hess, who was famously the deputy Führer who had parachuted into Scotland asking for a peace treaty and stayed as a prisoner of the Soviets in Spandau Fortress in West Berlin.
Spandau Fortress, then prison being where a lot of the Nazis wound up after the end of the war.
Yeah, and basically everyone had been released except for Hess up until the 1980s when he'd gone completely mad, but the Soviets really refused to allow his release. He was the last guy left in this prison completely alone. And which was a strange situation, but the main people concerned about it were people who had also been demanding the release of other war criminals. And so you'd have these marches of, we're demanding justice for poor Rudolf Hess, this guy who's been unjustly railroaded by the evil communists, but it would basically be attended by the far right / neo-Nazi movement, who then couldn't put out swastikas, but they could wave around the imperial flag. And so you have this adaptation process of how can the far right and neo-Nazis in general, how can you exist in the German public sphere while also just getting up to the line of what is acceptably and legally allowed within the discourse? How can you sort of praise things in a way that's coded that won't get you in trouble with the Office of the Protection of the Constitution for saying that you want the destruction of the illegitimate liberal democratic regime imposed by the Nazis or by the Allies, but also sort of actually create some sort of in-group signal communication and organization that achieves your goal? So things like Spandau Prison and then Dresden much more publicly, because Spandau Fortress is in the middle of nowhere. It's out in sort of far suburbs of Berlin. And in Dresden, there's people marching right in the downtown. And this also results in a lot of sort of counter-mobilizations, where you have the left trying to mobilize under the slogan from some people in the anti-German movement of Bomber Harris, do it again. So you end up having this sort of very...
Bomber Harris being the Royal Air Force general who helped kind of mastermind the firebombing, which sort of reached its most notable case in Dresden, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have this situation where you have the German far left sort of praising the firebombing of Dresden, praising British fire sort of attacks on German civilians, while the far right coming out and talking about sort of the deep humanitarian violence of Allied bomber campaigns.
Extremely hard to describe to Western leftists when it's like the firebombing is like, yeah, well, okay, it was a noble cause fighting the Nazi regime, of course, but yeah, maybe that was not that great to bomb a bunch of civilians. Is sort of the left take on World War II in most of, you know, the US or the UK, and then yeah, the elements of the German left being like, thank you, Bomber Harris. They're like, yeah. Wait, what is happening here? What's going on? So, and you mentioned, you know, there are these different kind of either physical locations like Spandau Prison or these historical events or symbols that are a way of laundering what's basically neo-Nazi ideology, but into a way that you can talk about legally in the Federal Republic, because there are a lot of limitations. Obviously, you can't go around carrying a Hakenkreuz, a swastika, or saying, you know, I am a Nazi. But there's these little ways of kind of slipping it into mainstream discourse in a way that won't get you arrested. Notable one, of course, as you mentioned, is the Reichsflagge, the German imperial war flag, or the Reichskriegflagge, because it's pretty clear what you mean when you're flying that flag. But okay, well, it's just the old German Empire, so it's not actually banned. There is a bit of irony here too, because it's not just the far right that sort of wants to go back to that era. You also see a lot of Prussian nostalgia and German imperial nostalgia that's in the kind of mainstream center. I mean, if you just look at what they're doing to the center of Berlin on an architectural level, but a lot of other places, you know, it's like, this is the sort of German history we can be proud of. And that happens both on an institutional level and also on the far right. And so I think there's a degree of irony that it's widely considered, oh, well, that's just code for being a Nazi to fly the German imperial flag. Say, oh, well, that's what the Nazis do. But then going back to the leaders of the German Empire and the architecture of the German Empire, that's just sort of, you know, that's fine. You know, we're okay with that. And so there's, again, you know, these interplays of this fluidity between far right, center right, and then just mainstream center. And it doesn't, there aren't quite the hard boundaries you would wish there would be in a lot of cases. And so I think this then takes us to the current millennium, and we obviously have to talk about the party, the AFD, which was founded originally, as we've discussed on this podcast before, as an anti-Euro party in 2013. But could you talk a little bit about the precursors throughout the 20th century that and the strands that lead up to the forming of that? And then after that, we can talk about actually how the party has grown and how it's related to the more kind of extra parliamentary far right movements and how that takes us to the present.
Yeah, as I mentioned, the groups like the Republicans, the German People's Union, they have a certain amount of success on a local level. And then get into the early 2000s, also the NPD comes back. They get into the parliament in Saxony and also in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern up in the Northeast. It's really sort of fractured. You've got a number, these parties come about due to personalities, due to local conditions. They're really good at exploiting specific grievances in certain places. In Southwest Germany, there's sort of discussion about the idea of sort of criminal foreigners after the opening of the borders with the expansion of the EU. This takes hold, and you actually start seeing this as a campaign point also within the CDU. But you don't have any one group that's able to take advantage of these currents completely, and especially not in a national level. So the DBU actually just sort of collapses and merges the NPD, and its founder, who had been this billionaire publisher, that once he's gone, the sort of whole thing falls apart. But with the AFD, it's not just these far right currents, but also changes within the Christian Democrats. And in the 1990s, the Christian Democrats are real, as I said, this vehicle for German reunification is European integration. Helmut Kohl and the CDU are really the main, some of the main proponents of European integration, the creation of the Euro. Germany is really behind this. And you have these factions within the CDU and CSU who are very unhappy about this, who are much more nationalistic, who essentially want German reunification without these Europeanization processes, who want Germany to sort of finally be unshackled. With reunification, you have this process called the 4+2 agreement, where the Allies finally relinquish their rights to military occupation and the limitations on German sovereignty. And within these factions, the idea, we've just gotten our sovereignty back and now it's being thrown away to the EU. So these unaccountable elites in Berlin are throwing away our national sovereign rights as Germans and the German nation and giving it away to Brussels. So similar to Euroskeptic rhetoric elsewhere, but with this added geopolitical sort of grand historical narrative. So when we get the early 2000s, sort of under Angela Merkel, who is the first East German leader of the party, also not really fitting in the cultural mold of the party, being a divorced East German woman scientist, as opposed to sort of party politician from the West who has come out of these sort of Catholic conservative political milieus, that within the party, it's seen that sort of the CDU had shifted, it moved more to the center, and it was trying to tack more to the center to undermine the Social Democrats who had won the first election in 1998 for the first time since the 1970s. So within the CDU, this idea that the CDU is moving too far to the left, and at the same time, the ongoing Euro crisis that's happening in different ways sparks a lot of anger from within these circles. The idea that Germany should leave the Eurozone, go back to the Deutschmark. And this is where you get the origin of the AfD, this sort of splintering off of the right of the Christian Democrats along the stragglers coming in from other far-right parties, coming together to form the AfD. And he said the front man for this band, Lücke, is at first a sort of liberal, ordo-liberal economics professors who are obsessed with the Euro. But you also have a long history in Germany of elite intellectuals being part of the far right. If you look at this sort of the trend of the Neue Rechte, the godfather is a guy named Armin Mohler, who had been Swiss born. He'd actually come to Germany in 42 trying to join the SS unsuccessfully, because he was deemed to be politically a little too unreliable. But he went through some ideological training, went back to Switzerland, and then the post-war became this publicist who pushed for this idea that there'd been a conservative revolution in the Weimar era. There was a conservative nationalist legacy that you could separate out from Nazism that needed to be reborn. And Mohler is both in the far right, but also has a lot of mainstream success amongst the center right. And what we see there is this, there's also this manifesto by Heidelberg professors talking about the need to prevent the overwhelming of the German ethnic people by foreigners. That comes out in the 1980s. So within these bastions of respectability amongst intellectuals, you have a combination of anti-Europeanization, anti-foreign sentiment, and this combination of these intellectuals along with this party politics and then street level far-right activism, all is really what's coming together with the AfD and then the rise of Pegida, which comes after that, which is really comes to prominence in 2015 with the Syrian refugee crisis. But Pegida is a street activist movement, the Patriotic Europeans for the Defense of the Occident. And it also had a precursor group called Hooligans Against Salafists. There's this sort of series of conflicts between different Islamic groups over what's happening in the Middle East with ISIS. And they sort of had these demonstrations of football hooligans saying how, like, we need to keep Islamic extremism off of German soil. And this then flows into these demonstrations that start happening every Monday in Dresden, where you have sort of a really several thousand people, this sort of ballooning populist demonstrations against migration, against refugees, in the name of being sort of, we are regular people who are afraid of the political elites allowing all of these foreigners in to destroy our culture.
And the day Monday being a quite deliberate one, right? The Monday being demonstrations having been protests against the GDR, helping contribute to the fall of East Germany. And then the sort of idea that they're kind of like a continuation of that legacy for more freedom. Is that what they're going for?
Yeah, you have this process where the far right, especially in East Germany, really starts to wear the mantle of 1989 and of the civil rights movement, human rights activists who were protesting against the SED, where they take on some of the ritualization, some of the language. And this is going back to what you mentioned before, the language in 89, the beginning appeal saying, wir sind das Volk, we are the people, which began as a way of trying to say, we are the people, party leaders don't actually represent us, and we need to be listened to. In many ways, sort of this very usefully ambiguous phrase to sort of demand dialogue with the party. And then it became, wir sind ein Volk, if we are one people. In this case, you have people in Dresden in 2015, what you get is people reviving these slogans and basically positioning themselves of, we are the people against an unaccountable, undemocratic regime in Berlin. Once again, we are recreating these Monday walks that people took, which formed a way of sort of creating spontaneous leaderless opposition. So it's harder for the Stasi to disrupt in the GDR. And in this case, it was actually an organized movement, but trying to make it into sort of, this is a spontaneous collection of the mass of the people showing that they are against the state. And so this idea that we are now the new dissidents under the Merkel regime. This is the new dictatorship. This is the new, what now in recent years has become sort of the left green woke dictatorship of the new Germany, is the way they put it.
And this sort of, you see this trope too, like DDR 2.0, like the East Germany 2.0, because I don't know, they want to add a speed limit somewhere or make cars not pollute as much or whatever. But yeah, so this, the sort of shadow that East Germany, the role that like the sort of mythologized East Germany plays in far right politics, especially in the East, is really important in a lot of ways. And like you said, sort of continuing to claim this mantle of the opposition, which you see in a lot of formerly communist countries, actually, there's sort of this battle over the legacy of 1989 and saying, you know, and you see a lot of the far right currents trying to take the saying, you know, we carry on the legacy. It's not the liberal democratic elements. It's, we are the real inheritors of that legacy. And this is the sort of peculiar East German version of that, having been folded into a new country, whereas in Poland or something, it manifests itself quite differently.
Yeah, I think the idea of an unfinished revolution in a lot of places. That in Poland, the idea of, we need to purge these lingering communists who are still in the system. Which is funny, because in East Germany, you did actually have a thorough purging of people connected to the Stasi. Your universities were cleared out of professors of Marxism, Leninism. The judiciary was completely sort of overtaken by West German officials. So really the German case is one of the most effective overhaul of the system to eliminate former communist influences. But
well, they had the benefit, like the whole sort of sub elite, like everyone that couldn't hack it in the West is like, okay, well, we've got a place for you now. And so there was someone to fill it in. Whereas when you have, as it, you know, sort of similar to what you mentioned with the fall of the Nazi regime, I'm not trying to draw an ideological similarity, but the idea that if a regime collapses and there's no kind of administrative and elite to fill that in, what are you going to do if you're, you know, the perspective of Poland, which of course puts East Germany in a different position because there's just the rest of Germany that can kind of swoop in and there's not an equivalent for any other post-communist society.
Exactly. It's really sort of on a practical level when you have an ideological regime change, who is going to just keep running the basic affairs of state? Who's going to keep the schools running? Who's going to be teachers? And so in this way that Merkel becomes, from the center-right Christian Democrats, and Angela Merkel particularly becomes the focal point for a lot of this, especially because of Merkel's decision to allow the influx of refugees in 2015, rather than, say, using mass violence on the border to machine gun everyone to turn them back, since they had been let through by other governments already up to the point where they're at Germany's borders. This idea of the German state decided to open its border, that Germany doesn't actually have an external border outside the EU. This is sort of a wave of refugees had been already let in by people like Viktor Orban, as everyone tried to sort of pass the buck down the system. And finally, Germany was the country saying, okay, fine, we'll settle people. And I think in this way, that Merkel gets sort of described as this great humanitarian for doing so. And on the one hand, the admission of close to 1 million people was incredibly important, but it was also a decision that was made only when other options had fallen away and when it was absolutely necessary because there's really no other choice.
Classic Merkel in exactly. Nutshell, basically. Yeah.
So, but in this way, the sort of deeply conservative, pragmatic decision to do this only as a last resort was turned into Angela Merkel as the crypto-communist agent of the destruction of the German people through its dilution by the admission of the Islamic and Arab other. And this becomes the paranoid, racialized understanding within the far right. On the other side, you have the more less ideological side of the far of people basically just sort of upset at the concept of mass immigration, upset at the idea that the state is doing this. And there's an effort to sort of take this incoherent sense of fear and resentment and channel it into a really ideological project with Pegida of making this into a mass demonstration populist movement. This is really at the time we've had Brexit, you have Trump around this era, and the idea that you can have some kind of populist upswing from within the population that will overturn the political order is something that people get very nervous about, that the mainstream political system is just out of touch with the real people of Germany. And you start having a lot of people in the center. Maybe we have to take a hard right on immigration. Maybe we have to go in this direction to try and overtake this. And this becomes part of the successor question of Angela Merkel. Despite within the Christian Democrats, there's a famous line from Franz Josef Strauss, who's a longtime leader of Bavaria and known as sort of hard right leader of the Christian Social Union there, that you can never allow a mainstream right-wing party to our right. And within the Christian Democrats as a larger political movement, there is this ethos that even if we don't agree with a lot of these sentiments, it's important that we keep these people in the big tent. That basically we are going to keep them inside the tent, feeling like they're respected, feeling like they're part of the system. And the option beyond that is that they could go into some sort of larger mass neo-Nazi movement. And within the Christian Democrats, even within the moderate wing, the idea that this is important to maintain this very broad center-right coalition. And so this question of who's going to come after Merkel becomes this fight over what degree you need to move further to the right to recapture these voters. Is it something you even want to do? Do you risk losing the gains you had from the center, from the people you picked up from the Social Democrats? And with the proliferation of parties, with the rise of the Greens and with the Linke, is Germany capable of having these sort of 45% voting people's parties that have a big wide tent anymore? Or do you just have to go for a narrow band and really focus in? So sort of the rise of the far, and then 2017, these are worst fears of people within the CDU feeling like they've gone to the left seem to be realized the AfD gets into parliament on this wave of populist anger. And then quickly the AfD ends up in every provincial parliament across the country.
And especially as we then come to the end of the Merkel era and the last, her last term, of course, with the most recent federal elections being in 2021, this question of how does the CDU position itself, it goes through these kind of fitful answers to that, right? You know, if first you have AKK, which is sort of the chosen successor of Merkel, also in kind of her vein, then Armin Laschet, which a little more, but roughly in the same vein. And then they perform so poorly, at least by, you know, their expectations in the 2021 elections, and the Social Democrats end up back in power with Olaf Scholz and of course our current Ampelregierung. Then the CDU has to do some soul searching, and they wind up with Friedrich Merz, who is a much different answer to this question of how do we position ourselves, and it's a clear break with Merkelism. So I think we can get back to Merz a bit, because there, it's not the CDU's answer to this question of how do we position ourselves relative to the AfD is impossible to answer without talking a bit about how the AfD itself develops, both in terms of its positions and its actual performance electorally. So in this period after 2013, now it's been basically a full decade since the party was established, you know, it's sort of the Euro crisis lights the spark. And then after that, there's this confluence of three main factors, I think you could say. Immigration, which obviously becomes very relevant very quickly in the party's history and really kind of catapults it quite quickly. And then opposition to climate change action, including what's now become like very pro-car rhetoric. And then more recently, the COVID restrictions. These all become key flashpoints for the AfD, and it tries to really channel opposition to them and parlay that into electoral success. So what goes on within the AfD, and how does it slowly become more and more radicalized? Because we've seen a trend that a lot of people I think weren't expecting, or at least not hoping for, whereas the AfD moves further and further to the right, and in doing so actually becomes more rather than less successful electorally.
Yeah, I think those are, it's correct with the big three, that we start, migration is really key, but then with the anti-green, anti-climate change message, that so much of this is really about the reconfiguration of the right after communism. That under the Cold War with the CDU, this idea that we are all part of a broader block of people opposing communism, part of the West, we are against this one, this sort of specific group, which is there as our ideological natural other. Without that as a glue to hold the center-right together, you need to find other things. And in this case, you've got migration and this idea, the sort of Islamic Arab other as the key enemy, the Greens as the new ideological enemy within, the new version of the left, which is there trying to undermine our way of life. And then COVID became a tangible everyday issue that they could play off of to try and really get people going with voting to this party over their existing patterns. But even before COVID started, I think this is where it's interesting to look at this sort of succession crisis of the CDU in connection with the AfD and its ramping up, that this election that happened in Thuringia in 2019 that produces a hung parliament is really crucial in what happens, that you have an election. Thuringia has is the only federal state where the left party is in charge. And it's a left party, which is led by a guy, Bodo Ramelow, who's actually from the West. He's from a sort of Christian socialist trade union background. That's one place where the left is able to come together to create a much broader based party and end up actually running a government. And it is also home to the most far right wing of the AfD, run by Björn Höcke, who is described by people within his own party as a Nazi. So within these Thuringian elections, the ruling government run by the left doesn't have enough for a majority. And there's this process where they're trying to sort of vote for who's going to become the new minister president of Thuringia. And the Free Democrats, who have been drifting further and further to the right, they put forward a candidate who gets elected with the support of the Christian Democrats and the AfD. And this becomes this crisis of, has this violated the CDU's own policy that we won't cooperate with the AfD? There's a national crisis, and this causes Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, the sort of the Merkel's successor, who is seen as the most Merkel-y of possible successors. She steps down in the midst of the scandal. And this is really sort of the beginning of this ongoing problem for the CDU, that they can't make coalitions with certain people on the left because that's out of bounds, but they also say they won't work with the AfD. And we're hitting a point of just sheer mathematical problem on how do you form a coalition government. So in Saxony, there's a similar issue of having to create this sprawling ideological coalition led by the Christian Democrats to make sure the AfD are in power. But it starts to create more and more incoherent governance, I'd say. And this thing we can see from the federal Ampelregierung, the Regierung that came in 2021 under Scholz, that you have political parties that are in government together that have very different priorities, creating a lot of contradictions and dysfunction that helps give material to the AfD to say that they are against this or corrupt collection of mainstream parties that are working against them and devoted to the status quo. And so if you don't like the status quo, you need to vote for us to really shake things up and finally end the tyranny of what's going on.
Yeah. And just to drive home this kind of political issue and just the mathematical point that you make, I mean, I think a lot of people will be familiar with the German proportional and parliamentary system, but you know, it's like you obviously have to get over 50% of the seats to form a government. And it's difficult to do that sometimes. But then imagine there's a piece of this pie that keeps growing, which is not supposed to go with anything and is supposed to be forbidden from you know, cooperating with. And so that gets to 30%, that gets to 40%. And all of a sudden, you're then supposed to combine the rest of the pieces to create a majority. But those range from the FDP to Die Linke. And like you said, it gets more and more coherent. And this problem of just basically simple addition gets more and more complicated. The bigger the pie piece that's doesn't allow it to go with the rest of it gets, therefore making the rest of your components you can sum up ever smaller. And that's why I brought up these polls at the start. You know, and we can link to some of this too. You can just kind of look at the little pie chart for yourself. Makes a lot more sense when you actually look at it rather than hearing me describe it. But it's really unclear what's going to happen, especially with some of the 2024 elections and how you actually get these things to go together and why some of the AfD is so beyond the pale. I mean, you mentioned Björn Höcke. This is just from Deutsche Welle here. They pull together a little greatest hits of racist comments from AfD politicians. And they just their little blurb here. The head of the AfD in the state of Thuringia made headlines in 2017 for referring to Berlin's Holocaust Memorial as a, quote, monument of shame, and calling on the country to stop atoning for its Nazi past. In July 2023, he echoed Nazi rhetoric by declaring that the EU must die so that true Europe can live. In 2019, a German court ruled that it's not slanderous to describe him as a fascist. So there you go. You can kind of see why this tension is there. Well, you know, obviously you can't be a respectable party and form a coalition with someone like that. But at the same time, if they're polling at 40%, how do you form a government that they're not involved? And like I said, no one really has the answer to that currently.
Yeah, I think there's two sides to this. On one hand, the AfD is constantly trying to dress itself up in more respectability. And this is one of the problems. They keep on losing some of the former CDU people they had who joined it on the grounds that they said, sort of, we're creating a liberal conservative alternative to the Christian Democrats, which is definitely not neo-Nazi. And then there's a little too much far-right neo-Nazi rhetoric. They quit in protesting, we're going to form a new party, and it completely fails. So you had the first founder of the AfD, Bernd Lucke. He loses to Frauke Petri. He forms the LKR. It goes nowhere. Frauke Petri then gets displaced. She decides to quit after getting elected to lead the party, saying it's gone to extremists. She forms the Blues. It goes nowhere. Recently, Jörg Meuthen, they revived the Center Party, which had been in Weimar. And he basically just gave up on that recently after having left the AfD. But this air of respectability where they try to come out and say, we are the true defenders of the Constitution. We are the real liberals. And this is where the COVID protests become important, where saying we are the defenders of individual rights. We are the defenders of freedom of the individual against the overbearing state. And we are the anti-totalitarians. So we can't be Nazis. We're against dictatorship. And so this combination of the history wars where they are sort of saying we need to overlook, really stop paying attention to the Nazi past, think about German greatness, But also,
it's only 12 years, Jelilo, over and over.
Exactly.
Why are we so focused on these 12 years when there's thousands of great German history? Yeah.
Yeah. From Hermann up until 1937, we can be very proud of everything that Germany did. And then let's just ignore the rest of that in the middle. And then on the other hand, sort of trying to push this idea of we are the good, respectable liberal Democrats. We are the normal party. And at the same time, really pushing hard on the idea of the destruction of this decadent mainstream. The status quo is something that is this imposed alien force that is trying to biologically eradicate the German nation. So these two registers they can speak in, on the one hand of the straight Nazi ideology about racial purity, and the other hand, one in which they're very concerned about liberal procedural basic rights being followed, and that they would like to be the ones to restore the proper rule of law. And this is also a problem where this sort of fig leaf of respectability goes, on the other hand, with the Christian Democrats under Merz, who really came in as he was going to be the right wing of the CDU's Avenger. He was going to come back, end the Merkel era, eradicate her mistaken tendency to go left, and he was going to reclaim the entirety of the right wing. And the opposite's happened. He's been pushing the party farther to the right, really pushing a lot of anti-immigration rhetoric, talking about how the Greens are the main ideological enemy of the party, and the AfD keeps on growing. And this idea is for theory within the CDU, among some people, that Merz would finally just sort of correct the wrongs, bring them back to 45%, snuff out the AfD, hasn't happened. But it's also closed off a lot of room to maneuver in the center, that with Merz going after the Greens so hard, right now in 6 of 8 provinces where the CDU is in government, they are working with the Greens. They are one of the natural governing parties or partnerships in the country right now. And you can see this in the election in Hessen, this awkwardness that the Christian Democrats, who lead a government in coalition with the Greens, is trying to run against the federal Ampel coalition because they can't come out and denounce the Greens, who they've been working with and will probably have to keep working with after the election. But with Merz pushing the party so far to the right, this simultaneous growth of the AfD and denunciation of cooperation with the left, and now sort of growing idea that sort of the Greens are the great enemy, is cutting off a lot of center and left partners that they could possibly work with. And in a system where minority governments are seen as pretty much innately illegitimate, we're going to just start having more math problems of how do you get to 50%.
And it's this bizarre trend, right? Because we mentioned, of course, the AfD moving to the right, and then the CDU sort of chasing them to the right, and then making the Greens this great ideological enemy at the same time as the Greens themselves have been becoming ever more centrist. I mean, this is something a lot of people on the more progressive left side in Germany really mourn, is, you know, the Greens now are just seen as such an establishment centrist party. And so they're becoming ever less radical. At the same time, they're being targeted as the great ideological enemy of the center right party. It's a very bizarre thing to watch. And like you said, if everybody is now beyond the pale to work with, how do we ever get to any kind of cohesive governments in a number of states? And like, so what, why have the Greens become so hated? Because I think you have, like I said, on the left, a lot of people growing increasingly annoyed with them for their kind of ideological moderation and centrism. I think there's probably something there. I mean, that's an observable trend. Maybe the degree of anger isn't always justified, but they have moderated. And from a left perspective, you can get angry at that. From a center right perspective, why have they gotten more annoyed at the Greens as they've moved closer ideologically?
And with the Greens, it's interesting. You look at them in government and you have these compromises on coal production. You have the migration pact they signed off on, which the Greens are really the party that was key in saying sort of human rights for and migration are one of our main planks, and really uniquely amongst a lot of the parties. And this has sort of fallen away when they've been in government. And a lot of the environmental fixes they've been proposing are very nudge oriented towards technocratic fixes of tax bonuses for certain kinds of heating. This is not a bunch of people who are eco-socialist anarchists who are trying to go back to the land and abolish modern technology. But there's been this tension in the center right for a long time as the Greens have become this more liberal, ecologically focused, centrist liberal party that really appeals to the same demographics of people who used to be voting Christian Democrat, and especially the FDP, that this tier of middle-class educated voters, especially in urban areas, who used to be open to voting for the FDP on the grounds that they are also sort of high-earning individuals who would be interested in lower taxes or just sort of concerned about abstract ideas about rights in the earlier form of the FDP where they cared about that. I think just on a pure partisan political level, the CDU and the FDP see themselves in a fight over key demographics that the Greens are sort of moving in on. You can see this in Bavaria, that you start having these areas where people who used to vote for the CSU are starting to look at the Greens. And they're not doing so on the grounds that they want eco-socialism, but they're concerned about conservation. They're interested in wind power because it might be valuable to their community. They're concerned about just environmental degradation in general and climate change. So in this way, it's really the threat of the Greens as a centrist alternative is the threat, not, but that is being disguised as the threat of eco-socialism, which is here to undermine your precious bodily fluids, steal your gas oven, and evict you from your home and put you into a Plattenbau.
So it's not, the hatred of the Greens is not in spite of them becoming more bourgeois. It's because of it, but they can't say that. They say it's because they're eco-socialist, but the real fear is actually because they are similar and they're taking their vote share.
Yeah, especially in Bavaria, you see this, that the Greens have a history of doing well in certain rural areas and certain places of sort of where people have these fears of the despoiling of the countryside. If you look at the anti-nuclear movement in the 70s, mobilization of people in farming communities who are worried about the effects of nuclear power on rivers and things like this, that there is a sort of chunk of the German electorate who is not on the left, who is open to more ecological messages. And this thing we also see within the far right with the Querdenker movement, this longstanding sort of slightly ecological but more sort of out there woo-woo ideas about the land going back sort of into the 19th century, that some of this ends up being about protecting the soil and some of it becomes about blood and soil. So there's a potential there for people to go in a different direction, and especially in Bavaria, undermining this hegemony of the CSU, which has been governing since 1949 without interruption.
Yeah, I mean, it's a whole other episode sometime, but the German eco-fascism is definitely, there's a lot to draw out there. We did an episode on natural medicines a long time ago, mm-hmm. and the ties between the kind of hippie left and the far right are many there. And it also goes to, of course, environmental politics. And so that takes us up to roughly the present here. And now I guess, you know, we've had some nice historically grounded discussions. Now it's, if we're speculating and, you know, talking about the present and the future, we obviously have to let ourselves descend into a little bit more rank punditry, which I think is fine after an hour of hard grounded discussions. But We'll try to keep it not too pundity. But so now we have the Greens as this huge target, the CDU kind of in some cases openly flirting with working with the AfD on a local level. There have been some backlash when that's been alluded to. But again, you know, it gets back to this math problem that we keep coming to. And so where are we and what do you see happening maybe in the next year or so, especially as to this question of, you know, they call it the firewall, right? Where all of the mainstream non-fascist parties will not work with a far right party. And everyone speculates, well, when is that going to break? Like maybe it'll break on the federal level at some point. And the common thing that people always say is, well, it'll erode on the local level and then the state level. And then maybe in 10 years time, we'll see the center right and the far right working together on the federal level. That's sort of like the prediction or like the smart money pick as far as the rise of the far right in Germany. Do you think that thesis is broadly correct, or where else might you take issue with that, or what else do you see as potentially happening?
I mean, I think I need to give a warning at the beginning that my political predictions tend to be incredibly bad, but I think I was just finding some old tweets of mine saying, obviously the ample coalition isn't going to function because it would be so, there's so many contradictory policy positions between the FDP and the Greens on migration and environment and transportation. It would be such a mess. I can't see it happening. So I feel like on the one hand, I'm pretty good at saying things are going to be a disaster. I'm bad at predicting they won't happen. But in this case, I think what we're seeing is the erosion of the idea of working with the far right, but not the erosion of working with the AfD. But the AfD as a brand is really toxic. But what we can see in the Bavarian election is how much this alternative party, the Free Voters, the Freie Wähler, that there's really been no political cost to them with their leader having been exposed to taken part in, I think, how to put it, sort of far-right activities as a youth. It's such sort of this pamphlet that came out of making comments about sending German traitors up the chimneys at Auschwitz, and generally being unrepentant about having a far-right background while being generally sorry, like a schoolboy who has to get out of trouble with the principal. But I think what we could be seeing more of is cooperation with proxies for the far right in different ways. I think what we're seeing is also the FDP, which has been moving significantly to the right on things like immigration. The thing that blew up the efforts of creating a coalition with the FDP in 2017 is that their voting base has become much more extreme in its anti-immigration tendencies. And so this idea that things will start at the local level, a lot of local CDU politicians are also very adamantly against working with the AfD, and that you actually have in a lot of pockets, this is where you get the really moderate AfD or really moderate CDU, that you've got this sort of good church going folk who have connections to the business community who just want a functional local government. The stereotype in a lot of places, but especially if you look at Schleswig-Holstein, you get a degree of moderation from, there's a small community, we don't have a ton of money, we need the government to function, let's make something happen. So I think this idea that the local level is the natural entry point to the fall of the firewall isn't necessarily true. But really worries me right now is the upcoming Saxony elections and the upcoming Thuringian elections. Because as with Thuringia, they ended up coming up with a minority government that's tolerated by the CDU. And essentially everyone's angry at this, that it's this, and it's sort of a corrupt bargain where they were supposed to have new elections a year later and they didn't, in particular because the CDU didn't, a faction of them didn't want to have elections thinking they'd lose. So this left-wing government has been kept in power by a group of CDU MPs who just don't want to lose their jobs and have to run for election again. And the government's been fairly, not completely hobbled, but there's been a lot of problems trying to run a minority government. And so in Thuringian, you have this upsurge for the AfD, which is able to run against the idea that every other party is part of a corrupt bargain to stay in power, so they can milk the system for benefits as opposed to work on behalf of the people. And Saxony, where you just, it's been a CDU stronghold since reunification, and the other parties just have never quite managed to take hold. And they're looking at a huge AfD win, which would also just wipe out possibly the Social Democrats, FDP, all the other smaller parties at this point, leaving the Christian Democrats to possibly come up with a coalition with the left, which they say is impossible. And again, we're back to the math problem. So
yeah, this is the Saxony numbers I mentioned at the start, but it's worth going back to contextualize what you're saying. Is one of the more recent ones I said it was 39% AfD, 32% CDU, and then the only other party clearing the hurdle, as you know, just one poll, but still, would be Die Linke at 6, which is just right on the edge. So, yeah, like, do you have a majority or a large plurality far right, and then the center right, and then a tiny left party? Like, what do you do with those numbers? Like, it's crazy.
No, I mean, previously, if we look at other places, the earlier problem of what to do with the Linke, in the early 90s, as the communist successor party in the East, a lot of parties said they couldn't make a coalition with them, but they came up with a toleration system. This is sort of called the Magdeburg model, based on what happened in Sachsen-Anhalt. And you essentially, they sort of get to be part of the government without being part of it. And then the other model came out of Schwerin in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern of just total non-cooperation with the NPD in any way. And so on the one hand, there is a precedent for mainstream parties who don't want to make a coalition with the left to try and figure out some kind of system to govern. But a 32% CDU having a minority government backed by a 6% Linke doesn't really clear the legitimacy test for a lot of people's ideas of how a functional majority government should work, and would just on a functional level be insane. I have no idea how that's supposed to work at all.
It brings up two problems, right? One, the actual just functioning and people saying we want our government to work. And the other is like this thing that the AFD can keep kind of coming back to, maybe in some cases with a degree of credibility, that, well, they're trying to kind of erase your vote, right? Like we're not being taken seriously, and these legitimacy questions you can keep coming back to. And so it's a very, very difficult problem.
And this thing that the AFD has been very good at is exploiting real legitimate problems with solutions that won't fix them and are oriented towards usually some kind of bigoted public policy that tries to end democratic pluralism. So there are complaints about immigration, the idea that you have towns that have refugee centers that aren't properly funded, there's enough work for integration. These things are valid. However, their solution is just mass deportation. They have no interest in actually trying to make these things work. And this is the problem, is you have a system that becomes more dysfunctional and seen as less legitimate. The AFD can keep on coming in and just hammering at that. And so this is where I think with the AFD, that a lot of the problems come from this sort of lack of social cohesion, the collapse of earlier social institutions that were so key to this consensual coalition-based German form of politics. And as you get more of a social collapse in a lot of these regions, the AFD, just as essentially a social and political arsonist party in a lot of cases, becomes appealing, not just as a protest vote, but also on the idea that people want to see things burn down. This isn't to say people aren't actually far right. They're just being protested. It's like, no, they want to protest by becoming far right in a lot of cases. And they are perfectly happy to see damage done on their behalf out of a sense of resentment and spite.
Yeah. And with being conscious of the time and not wanting to hold you here too long, but maybe a good way to close out would be this question of what to do with the AFD, because there is this discussion where people want, there's some discussion of just banning the party. I mean, they've been under surveillance from the Verfassungsschutz for quite a while, especially in certain areas of their Flügel, the wing, is like considered an extremist organization. And even pretty recently, federal president Steinmeier, he didn't say directly, but kind of alluded to, like, well, parties that don't believe in democracy shouldn't participate or be allowed to participate in the democratic system. Pretty clear what he's referring to there. It doesn't seem like a totally like seriously considered proposal or something that's imminent in terms of banning them. But it is something a decent amount of people are talking about on different sides of, well, you know, we shouldn't let this anti-democratic party run in democratic elections. And they always go back to the 1930s and say, well, Hitler was elected democratically and then they got in power and got rid of democracy. So we need to learn that lesson and not allow them to even get elected in the first place. The response to that is something similar to what we were saying earlier, is that, well, no, if you ban them, the actual energy there isn't going to go. It's not going to go away. It's just going to get transferred to something else. And you're going to actually inflame people more and make them angry that you're not listening to their voice. And so we've kind of just had this wait and see approach of everyone saying, well, I hope they'll just go away by next election, and they keep not going away. So what do you see the different options as far as what to do about the far right, the rise of the far right, and especially in its electoral, especially in its electoral form of the AFD?
I think the chance to actually just ban the party as an anti-democratic force has been lost. That was something that needed to happen before 2017. I think banning a party that's at 40% in the polls is something that's not politically functional and is not a technique that would actually produce the results you want. As I said, sort of the energy's still there. There's too much momentum. And yeah, there's the Weimar analogy is a danger, that you get a party that doesn't have a majority, but is helped into power by the respectable right. However you want to define that, both back then and now, and then starts to eradicate institutions that could actually provide a firewall to maintain any kind of pluralism and the rule of law. this is actually a huge danger. And I think one of the problems is this idea of the firewall to the far right was not taken seriously outside of pure electoral coalitions, that it was not adopted as an ethos. It was adopted as a strategy for one specific part of the democratic process. And the idea of trying to just ape what they were doing by many different factions, also looking at Zalewagen Connect, you have people with this sort of left populist idea that if we just become anti-immigrant enough, we can capture that energy, this sheer sort of power of the people in the street. And I think that that has proven itself to be false and incredibly dangerous, and that having people on the left encouraging a xenophobic politics on the ground that the German people are just naturally kind of bigoted and the only way we get them on board is with this sort of politics ends up just fueling this. So I'd say my problem is that there's the good liberal centrist idea of just say they're illegal doesn't work. The left populist idea of if we just offer them enough welfare benefits while being racist, I think doesn't work. I think it's a massive coordination problem that it basically takes all the mainstream parties trying to actually box them out and not encouraging their policies, but they want their voters. So this is the part where I get to do the academic historian cop-out of saying, I really have no idea how this is supposed to work because all the good solutions are too late or non-politically functional. And I have a deep amount of concern about how things are going to go in Saxony and Thüringen, because I think based on what happened in the last Thüringian elections, there was a lot of people who spent way too much time doing the wrong thing before they tried to do the right thing. And it's only made the problem worse.
Yeah, well, definitely keep an eye on these 2024 elections in these two states. Like you said, not a ton that looks very promising. I guess what you alluded to, just for context, we should say that it looks like Zalewagen Connect is now forming her own sort of splinter party. They say, oh, we're going to cut the AfD vote share in half. And so we did a whole episode, you know, about this a couple ago. We'll link to it with Lauren Ballhorn about the prospects of a Wagen Connect party. You know, I don't want to try to do the thing where people close out on a hopeful note, and that hopeful note is Zalewagen Connect's party. That's not what I'm implying here at all, but that is something to watch out for. Their internal polling says they could do well and maybe take away vote share from the AfD, but that's definitely gets a wait and see from me on that. So yeah, that's probably takes us to a good amount of time here and a ton of great information. Really appreciate you coming on and sharing that with us, Ned. Do you have any sort of closing thoughts about this or any other thoughts, whether historical or pundity?
No, I think I'd just leave it there that I think there isn't sort of a one simple trick that's going to be showing up. It's a big, complicated, messy problem that's taking place across a huge range of political spaces and different parts of different parties. And I think that's really the difficult thing right now is this multiplicity of it. It's not just sort of come up with one better form of messaging, come up with one new party, or just hit the button that says you're illegal.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we see some evolution of solutions to this on different states. Obviously, like you said, the problem is there's this overall rise of the far right problem that we discussed, but it manifests itself very differently in the different state contexts. And so we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But yeah, Ned Richardson Little, thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find
Thanks
your
for having
work
me.
Stay updated on your thinking if they'd like to?
So I've got, I'm fairly active on Twitter, though, as it's gotten more and more of a cesspool. Moved over to Blue Sky recently, which is very sleepy. But for the moment, I'm keeping a presence on both places, and probably the easiest place to catch up on me is there.
Okay, great. We'll definitely link to your work. And thanks again for your time and your sharing your thoughts with us. This was a really great conversation, if a slightly sobering one.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you. Thanks so much to everyone for listening. We hope to see you next month in Berlin at the live show. And we, of course, again, really appreciate your support with the show on Patreon. Link in the show notes. Tschüss.
Tschüss.